Former Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger says he may end his campaign for the U.S. Senate. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about a new report that shows wolf numbers are declining in Yellowstone National Park. And in our tonight's feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with Montana's Suicide Prevention Coordinator, Mark Rosten. Former Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger says he may end his campaign for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate if current Lieutenant Governor John Walsh is appointed to serve the rest of Max Baucus's term. If Baucus resigns from the Senate to become the next U.S. ambassador to China, it will be up to Governor Steve Bullock to pick an interim replacement until January 2015. Walsh has asked Bullock to appoint him, but the Democratic governor has kept quiet on a possible selection. Bollinger tells KGVO AM that if Bullock picks Walsh, Bollinger, quote, would give serious thoughts to withdrawing from the race, end quote. Bollinger says the interim appointment would give Walsh the power, name recognition, and fundraising ability of an incumbent, making it almost impossible to defeat him in the election. And in other news from around the state, an investigator for the Montana Human Rights Bureau has found reasonable cause to believe a Missoula County Sheriff's deputy faced discrimination and retaliation because of his support of a candidate for sheriff. Deputy Jason Johnson filed a grievance, complaining that he lost his position as public information officer after Detective Sergeant T.J. McDermott and Johnson announced plans to run as sheriff and undersheriff. Johnson said Sheriff Carl Ibsen then told him he would have to use vacation time to attend grievance meetings. Patrol Sergeant Bill Burt told investigator Dennis Unsworth that on at least three occasions, Ibsen told him that he would, quote, do anything within his power, end quote, to prevent McDermott from being elected. Bureau staff will now try to reach a settlement. If that is not possible, a hearing will be held. A company hauling a huge load of evaporating equipment to an oil sands project in Alberta has finally been able to bring the load into Montana. The Ravalli Republic reports the 380-foot-long, 450-ton load traveled over Lost Trail Pass into Montana and stopped south of Darby early yesterday, where it drew crowds throughout the day. The load began moving at about 10 p.m. last night, rumbled through Hamilton at about midnight, and stopped at the Lolo weigh scales. The next leg of the trip will take the load through Missoula and on Interstate 90 to Bonner before it heads north to the port of Sweetgrass. A second smaller load was parked in Salmon, Idaho, and a third and final load is in Oregon, waiting to begin its move. A new report shows a declining population of wolves in Yellowstone National Park. The most recent annual report from the Yellowstone National Park Foundation shows 83 wolves in the park at the end of 2012, a drop of 15% from the previous 3 years. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us it's a result of the predators coming into balance with their environment.
The number of wolves are here that can be supported by prey.
That's Doug Smith, Yellowstone National Park senior wildlife biologist and leader of the Yellowstone Wolf Project. There has been a dip in the population, but he says overall, it looks like wolf numbers are stabilizing.
In the early days, there were just a lot more elk, and so that produced a lot more wolves. And those days are kind of over, and so we have fewer wolves in the park as a result.
He's careful to point out wolves were not solely responsible for the decline in elk. There are more mountain lions and bears in the park, too. Montanans were hunting more elk on the park's northern boundary. And Smith says there's increasing evidence showing elk decline due to climate-related factors. But with less of their primary food source, wolves in the park have started looking around for other things to eat, like the carcasses of bison and moose. Overall, Smith says the leading cause of wolf deaths in the park today is other wolves.
Wolves go looking for food, which means they trespass on other wolf pack's territories. And because they're territorial, they fight back.
Meanwhile, populations in Montana also seem to be reaching a state of balance. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks spokesman Ron Ossheim says at least that's the case in regions where they've been for a while.
We don't have that sense where they haven't expanded into new territories. And we know there are places in Montana that can support wolves, and it's only going to be a matter of time for them to move into those niches, we call them.
FWP predicted there was a minimum of 625 wolves in the state at the end of 2012, a decrease of 4% from the previous year. Ossheim says 2013 numbers should be available in about a month. So far in the 2013-2014 hunting season, Montana hunters have killed 123 wolves. Another 47 have been killed by trappers. Ostheim says the state wants to continue to manage wolves in a way that satisfies landowner tolerance and minimizes impact on big game populations.
We haven't had enough experience yet to know where we're going to need to be to reach that balance. That's really the art here and the science.
The wolf trapping season runs through the end of February, and hunting runs through March 15th. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Sundance Lookout, a film festival on the southern shores of Flathead Lake, is offering the opportunity to view the productions of filmmakers from across the globe. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more about the cultivation of an international cinema fest in the small town of Polson.
Last year, the Flathead Lake International Cinema Fest, or FLIC, showed more than 30 films from new and emerging filmmakers. 2014 marks FLIC's second year, and the number of films has more than doubled to 79. A trailer advertising the Cinema Fest pieces together clips from movies that will show. There's a man and a woman dancing, a cowboy standing in the street of an old-time western town, a man riding a horse under a big sky. Cinema Fest producer David King says they're showing a wide variety of films, from documentaries to features.
Well, that's what's great about the Flathead Lake International Cinema Fest is we do not have a theme. And if a movie is interesting, and if it's something that we feel warrants being seen by other people, we are really excited to have it be part of the festival.
King says this year they received about 100 local and international submissions.
We're represented by New Zealand and Kazakhstan and France.
Austria.
Austria.
Puerto Rico.
Serbia, Canada, and the United Kingdom are also on the list. Daniel Smith co-chairs FLIC.
I think what makes our festival unique, too, is that, you know, we are screening a lot of short films this year, and this is something that most of the general public doesn't get to see at the regular theater because distributors just don't pick them up. So this is a great way for these filmmakers, too, to show their films because it's generally not available to the public.
Smith says this Cinema Fest is also part of a larger effort to bring people to Polson during the slower seasons.
It does hurt the businesses around here. They've got to make their money during the summer because the winter season is so lean. So that's where we're hoping that this festival is going to draw a lot of visitors from Montana and outside the state as well.
Summer is Polson season, with Flathead Lake at the town's front porch and rafting on Flathead River out back. Golf and cherry season is big draws. Smith says this year they received a grant from the Montana Film Office to advertise outside a 100-mile radius of Polson. They advertised in papers across Montana, northern Idaho, Canada, and Smith says people have been buying tickets from Bozeman, Missoula, Kalispell, Columbia Falls, as well as out of state in Washington, Utah, and Colorado. Smith says they're having second screenings of some films. Last year, they had to turn people away at the door. They hope to avoid that this year. King says technology is making quality production more affordable, and the Cinema Fest offers a platform for people to show their work. One film was produced on an iPad.
You can buy a camera, and you can buy an editing program, and with a little bit of finesse, you can put together a really special project, and you can do it on a budget. So it's changed enormously in the last 15 years or so.
King says a film produced in Montana called When Winter Ends features a skiing fisherman.
And it's about an adventurer who, during the winter, goes way up north in the mountains and skis down them, climbs mountains, and then does hardcore skiing. And in the summer, he's an avid fisherman. He's a catch and release fisherman. It's beautiful, really well done.
There's another film, Anna Jam, which features Post-its.
Like Animation Jam. And he got several other artists, I think about 10 or so artists. 15 artists to do little shorts on Post-it notes. Really fun stuff. You've got to see the animation portion of this program.
King says there's animation for kids under and above 18 years old. Another film is called Hercules 3.0 and was put together by a group out of Utah following in their father's footsteps. It takes a comical look at two Hercules movies made in the late 1950s.
They decided to turn it into a completely dubbed project where they add their voices and they inject themselves bodily into the films by going against green screen.
This group of filmmakers is coming up for the Cinema Fest. They're among many. Smith says there will be an opportunity to meet with filmmakers on Saturday night. King is one of three judges who chose the films. He says a key criterion is that the film has to be watchable.
If it's extremely violent, we're not really wanting that. We don't want to shock the community, or if it's really graphic sexually or something like that. But by and large, the submissions we receive are sincere filmmakers' efforts to either entertain or inform.
The Flathead Lake International Cinema Fest kicks off Friday night and runs through Sunday. Smith says they hope to keep growing and may even add another day next year. Tickets and schedules are available at the Cinema Fest website, flickpolson.com. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
As we've reported this week, the state's recently appointed suicide review team has pledged to review every suicide that occurs in Montana this year to try to determine the reason and recommend ways to reduce the state's suicide rate, which is nearly twice the national average. The team, appointed in November by Governor Steve Bullock, includes a pastor, psychologist, psychiatrist, a sheriff, a school's official, and a social worker, along with Carl Roston, the state's suicide prevention coordinator for the past 6 years. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Roston explains he has intimate and tragic firsthand knowledge of suicide's impact.
I have a clinical background. I've been a therapist for more than 20 years. But I'm also a survivor of suicide. I lost a sister to suicide in 1987, and so suicide prevention has always been a focus of mine.
This is a dumb question, but what was that like for you?
There's no way to explain it. It's different for everybody, and the amount of pain and suffering that people go through is unimaginable, and it's hard to explain. I will tell you that, let's see, we're 27 years past it, and my parents still haven't recovered. Oh, they never will. It's beyond words, and it's very individual. It's just a pain that always looking to understand, yet there's no way to truly understand.
Is there, even all these years later, is there a sense in your family that, oh gosh, I could have done something to prevent that?
I think that exists a little bit, but the more I've done this, I realize that this was also an incredible amount of pain and suffering that my sister experienced in her own private world that none of us were able to understand or recognize. We could always sit there and say, well, yeah, they gave this warning sign and this warning sign. And in the end, it doesn't accomplish anything. You know, it's driven my work as the suicide prevention coordinator to be able to maybe help others recognize the signs so that they can intervene. But I think a little bit of that's always going to be there.
What are the warning signs?
We're looking for a change in character. You know, the person didn't usually do this, and now they are. So there's a talk or a theme of death or talking about dying. There is an increase in alcohol or substance use. Perhaps there might be episodes of crying and that type of just clear signs of depression. But then there's also high-risk behavior, whether it's drug use, whether it's sex, whether it's shopping. That can be the kind of a reckless impulsiveness. There's usually changes in sleep patterns or eating patterns, and that can be too much or too little. There is a loss of interest in things that they usually find pleasurable, you know, whether it's something that they used to always love to do, and now they've just, you know, they've dropped off the football team or they dropped out of school. They start to isolate. That's a huge one. They start to pull away from their peer group. They start to pull away from family. They don't communicate as well. One-word answers, or they kind of disappear and just choose to stay by themselves. Those are all just some of the warning signs that we look for.
Mr. Rustin, we're here to talk about the suicide review team, but first maybe let's talk about its reason for being. Montana's suicide rate, I know, is nearly twice the national average. What does that mean in terms of numbers?
It's important to use the term rate because of our sparse population. Our numbers, I mean, if you were comparing us, of course, to a place like Washington or California, it wouldn't seem much. But we lose somewhere between 225 to 230 people to suicide each year in our state. But that gives us a rate of around 23 per 100,000, and the national average is about 12.
And how do these people most commonly take their own lives?
Well, that varies in different states, of course, based on access to the means. But nationally, about 50% of all suicides are by firearm. But in Montana, that number is about 64-65%.
And is that broken up pretty evenly between men and women, or do women choose a less violent way?
Women tend toward less violent means. A typical profile of someone who attempts would be a woman who overdoses. Typical profile of a completion is a male who uses a firearm. We are seeing an increase, though, in the number of females who do use firearms.
I wonder why.
Just easier access to them, and it's going to be more lethal.
And why do people, most importantly, make this decision? Is it drug, alcohol abuse, isolation, not a lot of money here in Montana? What?
Yes. it's a number of factors. I think it's hard, especially when we take a look at different factors. I mean, if you take a look at the top 10 states for suicide, they're all Rocky Mountain region states. From Alaska right down through Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Idaho. There's a number of factors that play into it, the social isolation, the access to firearms, socioeconomic, alcohol and substance abuse. There's even a correlation with altitude. So there's a number of factors, and some of them play heavier in certain states than other states.
Altitude, now that's I've never heard of.
Yes, yeah, there's been a couple studies that both found a positive correlation with altitude, and one theory is that it's metabolic stress caused by long-term oxygen deprivation. The other theory is that people who live at higher altitudes are more isolated, drink more, and have more guns. So either way, we know that there is a correlation.
And I think anyone who's experienced depression, real depression, not just feeling bummed out, knows that it's a state of hopelessness. There's no optimism, and that's got to play a role.
I'm glad you brought that up, because when we take a look at all the factors that play into our high suicide rate, stigma against mental illness is the biggest. Mm. We still see depression as a weakness, and if we are depressed, we see ourselves as being a burden. And that stops us from asking for help. And that is one thing that is significantly different than other areas of the country. For instance, I mean, in New York, it's cool to have a therapist. Everybody has a therapist. Well, that's not the case in Montana or the Rocky Mountain region. I see people who are ashamed about having to come to therapy or come to the counseling. And when we start to hide that, that's when we are at the greatest risk. And if I had to say there was an overall goal of a lot of the stuff I do, is that to challenge that stigma and make it okay for us to talk about depression and suicide.
Yeah, but you're asking for a lot.
I am. And that's another important piece, because our rate of suicide has been high for 100 years. It's a cultural issue in our state, and it's going to take a cultural shift in thinking. And I'm very, very aware that that is going to be a slow process that will take generations to do.
Is this country focused enough on our mental health needs?
No, I think, although we talk about the stigma being the greatest in the Rocky Mountain region, that stigma exists elsewhere. We've attached a shame or a fear with mental illness that we wouldn't do with cancer or diabetes. And yet we're talking about many times that we are talking about a biologically based illness that can be treated if we bring it to our awareness and ask for help.
But there's still so much about brain disease that we don't understand.
Oh, incredible amounts. And we're learning more and more about it, but it's a slow process. We're very limited in the amount of we know actually about how the brain operates.
Mr. Rustin, and then there are these cases of the sort that recently affected Butte, where at least three school students took their own lives within 6 weeks. What goes through your mind when you see that unbelievable phenomenon?
Well, there's a great deal of sorrow for the pain that the community is feeling. Unfortunately, it's not uncommon. It seems every few months we have a community where there is an epidemic of suicides. It's reaching out to those communities and trying to get them the awareness. Unfortunately, many times, the awareness isn't raised after one suicide. It's usually two or three. And it always raises attention when a child makes that decision that they'd rather be dead than deal with what they're dealing with.
Why that grouping, though? That's what I don't get.
Well, a lot of times, there's a fear around, you know, it's kind of like that threshold of where they don't know what to do with their pain, and there are lots of ideas come in. And many times, especially with kids, there's an impulsiveness that goes with suicide. We know from the research that almost a third of all youth suicides occur within the first hour of having the first thought. So many times it's an act of impulse. And so when you have one child that does it, it brings down that threshold. And all of a sudden makes it more accessible or somehow okay.
But back up, what was that stat, the first hour, first thought?
Six? About, with adolescents and young people, about 30% of those suicides occur within the first hour of having the first thought. Now, it becomes less of an active impulse as we get to middle age and elderly, but definitely with our young. And they're known for doing things without thinking. It's kind of part of the development.
Tell us about this suicide review team.
Yes, we understand the national numbers, and we know the national research. But in the 6 years that I've had this position, what I have found is things that were developed back east don't apply to Montana. I think the governor's goal in creating this team was for us to take a close look at why we are losing so many people and to see if there's some factors that we're missing, to better understand the process and the dynamics and the relationships and the underlying issues. Because when we start to do that, then we can start to earmark prevention efforts to that population. And I'm even hoping that as we start to take a look and really gather just large amounts of data and be able to interpret and investigate into it, maybe we can find issues that are a community-based issue so that we can really focus our prevention efforts on those communities that need the help.
How will you all be doing this, and how many suicides do you predict you'll be investigating?
Our goal is to be able to look at all of them in some way, and then we will be picking or choosing certain ones to do as close to what we can call a psychological autopsy, and that is to really take a look at the history. But the way we have it set up, or we're hoping to have it set up, is when a suicide occurs, for us to work closely with coroners around the state to get the information, the death certificate, as soon as possible and get all of their notes and everything, and then for us to ask questions and get as much help as we can from them, and then through that process to be able to maybe talk with a family physician about if there is a history or if there's health issues, mental health issues, that type of thing. Work with mental health providers and understanding what the sequence of events that might have been had led up to this, because then our hope is that if we can understand that, then we can start to provide some prevention and intervention.
Gosh, it sounds like dark work.
It is. Then it's going to be a very daunting task. And I imagine that we're going to run into barriers. That's even part of the process. We have to understand the barriers and as a group and as a state, take a look at how we can overcome those barriers.
I guess maybe to wrap up, you're not some guy who's been to a seminar and thinks he knows it all about this issue. You've lived it.
I've lived it, and I have a lot of experience in it, and I'm still not an expert. This is a constant evolution of growth, and there's plenty of things I might know, but there's a lot more that I don't. It's a constant growth process.
Maybe, just maybe, somewhere out there in the audience, there is a man or a woman who has been rolling around this thought, taking his or her own life. If you could sit this person down, what would you tell this person?
Well, I always want to be careful because I'm not trying to guilt trip them. The biggest thing I would say is, there is hope. The pain doesn't last. And that's one of the things that happens. There's a sense of hopelessness and helplessness that the person feels. And quickly they start to think, it's always going to be this way. Nothing's ever going to change. And that's the piece that people have to understand. Nothing is forever except death and taxes. So the pain that they're suffering and they're experiencing, we know from the research that most of the time when a person hits suicide crisis, we're talking about a 72-hour window of when the pain is the most intense, and then it tends to subside. Now, it might come back, but it doesn't always stay at that level. And especially with depression, if treated, depression is one of the most treatable of all psychiatric disorders, if talked about.
Depression, though, is also one of the most consuming, terrible feelings to experience.
Yes.
And I know.
It is. It's overwhelming. It is all-consuming. It changes how you see the world.
It does. Mr. Carl Rostin, Montana Suicide Prevention Coordinator. Boy, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Best of luck to you and your team.
Thank you very much.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with areas of freezing fog, and lows should be 15 to 22 degrees. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs in the 30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect from 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. tomorrow for snow across most of central Montana. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with lows in the 20s. Tomorrow calls for cloudy skies with snow and highs 25 to 35 degrees. And in southwest Montana, that winter weather advisory is also in effect from 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. tomorrow for Broadwater and Gallatin counties. Tonight should be mostly clear with lows in the 20s. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow through the day and highs in the 30s. And now for the editorial comments of Pat Williams.
We are only a couple of weeks away from a tragic anniversary. That was the 2003 tragedy of the space shuttle. It was almost unbearable. You, of course, recall those white lines of death high in the Texas sky cut harshly through our then depressed nation. That was more than 10 years ago. More than 50 years ago now, America accepted the great challenge of leaving Earth's bonds and traveling into space. We experienced national pride and genuine patriotism when we became the first people to put men on the moon. It was 1969, 45 years ago, when the Eagle landed and Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. President John F. Kennedy, in a bold presidential directive, had, a few years earlier, challenged the Congress and America to authorize a space program and appropriate the money necessary to, quote, put a man on the moon and return him safely to the Earth. And America did it. At the time, I was teaching sixth graders in Butte, and was so taken, as I think we all were, with our nation's extraordinary efforts that I developed a course for my students about the space program, its successes and difficulties, focusing on the importance of America's efforts to lead the world in innovative ideas and achievements in science and peace. I became, along with most Americans, a vigorous advocate of manned spaceflight, and I continued that support for almost 2 decades. However, toward the end of the 1980s, and by then with years of experience in the U.S. Congress, I and many others began to reconsider the value of manned spaceflight. Our nation had changed in those 2 decades. Our national priorities had been rearranged, with defense taking an ever greater percentage of the federal budget. Our critical domestic needs of education, health care, and other national imperatives were, for the first time in a half century, being neglected. The space program was consuming tens of billions of dollars annually, and Congress was beginning to realize that the benefits of manned spaceflight were limited. NASA was touting Tang, Teflon, and Velcro as the byproducts of our missions in space. It's no wonder that the support of Americans was wearing thin. Billions for Tang? I began to believe, based on congressional briefings, hearings, and readings, that although our efforts in space should definitely continue, we should no longer pay the exorbitant costs necessary to continually send men and women into space. Those efforts were not only enormously expensive, but were also far more dangerous than NASA was publicly admitting. In the early 1980s, the taxpayer was investing $200 million for each manned flight, and NASA was promising that the flights would pay for themselves by 1986. It never happened. What did happen in 1986 was the terrible and unnecessary, as we now know, Challenger explosion, a horror watched by children in their classrooms all across America because, as we all remember, a teacher, Krista McAuliffe, was on that flight. Because of my early support for our nation's bold launches into space, I was, as a congressman, saddened every time I cast a no vote against NASA's manned flight budget. I voted against it many times throughout the 1990s. I had become an opponent of the high costs of sending humans into space because, in fact, many, perhaps most, of the same scientific results could be achieved by unmanned satellites. Congress heard from many scientists telling us that same thing. The tragically lost Challenger shuttle cost $1.7 billion. The entire manned space shuttle program back then cost $25 billion a year. And frankly, it simply wasn't worth it. Congress began to reconsider its support of manned flight and actually voted to significantly control those costs. Although astronauts in space gave us great pride, that program, I was always sad to say, had become the most expensive, dangerous, and wasteful single federal program. Today, 10 years after the Columbia tragedy, the space program costs have shrunken to $17 billion annually, with about half of that committed to manned exploration and operation. That is less than one half of the dollars spent on the manned space program of 20 years ago. Does America belong in space? Of course. But we must continue to try to do it with the least dollars necessary for good results. This is Pat Williams. Thanks for listening.
Pat Williams is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mgpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.